Okay, I realize that's sort of a video for a less mature crowd than yourselves, but I assume on Sunday morning you'll have many more of those aged people. So you will hear a lot about this from Justin next week, because Justin leads another of our Israel mission trips. And I encourage you to encourage your children and or grandchildren and or any young people 18 to 30 you have influence with to go on one of these trips and help them do it. It's, yes. Yes, my dad is on a task force exploring that option. Here's the problem. Adults work, and they don't all have the same time off. So what we're gearing it probably towards is the summer, because, you know, I think we're just saying, okay, teachers have the summer off sometimes, so let's aim it towards that, and everybody else, if they want to join in. Problem is, we'll have people say, well, I have October off. Why can't you do it then? Well, I have June off. Why can't you do it? And also, sometimes the people that want to do it aren't physically able. So that is a big concern. I have people that come to New York that aren't physically able to lead out to do outreaches. And if they can't do New York, they definitely can't do Israel. So it's a concern. But, you know, please do think about those that are younger than you. And this is an incredible opportunity. I've led this trip several times. Now Robin is leading it. And she was my partner in crime when we lived both in New York. We shared an office in our Manhattan headquarters, and we just brainstormed the heck out of things, and now we're actually trying to brainstorm a trip where we bring young people to minister to Holocaust survivors in Poland. So the Israelis get the Israeli Holocaust. They've moved to Israel. They're survivors who now live in Israel. We have a ministry to them there where we will actually fly them to a retreat center in Poland, and they love this. There's always a waiting list. That's how much they love our program. We work with them, we share the Lord with them, and we're working on bringing a bunch of younger Christians to serve them while they're there. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I know you can. The problem is a lot of young people can't imagine. So, anyway, I want to share a little bit about our ministry here in Chicago specifically, because there were a few questions, and I don't think I got the idea across very clearly, so I want to make sure I do that. And then we're going to talk not only about the Feast of Sukkot or the Feast of Booths. I can't talk about that in a vacuum, because the Feast of Booths is the culmination of the holiday year in Judaism. I have to talk about it with the two holidays that precede it. But first, let me share a little bit about Chosen People. I shared with you about the history of Chosen People. I've been with Chosen People Ministries officially full-time for almost 8 years, and I was with Chosen People loosely while I was doing my undergrad and graduate for about 2.5 to 3 years before that. I lived in New York City for 4 years, where I did ministry mostly to college students and young professionals. I started things called like Metro Moses, which was a young adult group, not within a church or a congregation or anything. It was just its own entity, and we had weekly Bible studies and monthly events. The weekly Bible studies were mostly for the believers, although there were occasional non-believing guests. The events were parties to bring non-believers to. So we share the gospel with many, many people like that. Some of the people I told you about, like Danit and Moti, I know they're both Israeli, which was just a coincidence. But they had interaction with all of these people. It's really a cool community. As well as I led a number of outreaches, like one we call STEP or Shalom Brooklyn. STEP, Summer Training and Evangelism Program, has been renamed Shalom Brooklyn. We bring in volunteers of all ages to New York City, and we do outreach in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and a little bit of Staten Island. Right after the hurricane went through a few years ago, and actually still, we did some tremendous ministry, not just need-based ministry, because oftentimes Jewish ministry is not need-based. Okay, you don't need to give people food or anything. But this was need-based ministry, and it allowed us to really build relationships with a lot of Jewish people in Brooklyn and in Staten Island. Then I moved to Washington, D.C. because I got married and I wanted to raise a family. And I didn't think that was going to be very easy to do in New York. But also there are over 30,000 Jewish students in the D.C. Baltimore area. So we moved there, and I can tell you that I struggled a lot. It became very apparent that Jewish college campus ministry is not like InterVarsity or Campus Crusade or Baptist Collegiate or Navigators or Young Life. does not work that way. When you start a Christian group on campus, you find a bunch of evangelicals who want to worship on a weekly basis. If Jewish people don't even go to synagogue on a weekly basis, why would they agree to do something like that? Doesn't make any sense. Why would they want to go to something that's about Jesus? They don't believe in Jesus. So you have to approach it very differently. And so I learned a lot. I learned how to not do things. I learned how to partner with college groups, because I really do think, like I'm encouraging you today, I really do think if I can get through to the Christian college kids, I will have much more access to their Jewish friends. Now, that doesn't mean I don't go directly to their Jewish friends. I do that as well, but I try to do both. So we were offered by my boss, Chosen People President, Dr. Mitch Glazer, to come to Chicago, and I am the Chicago branch director. I've been here since December, and like I said, I will become the Midwest regional director in a few months. So we have a lot of ministry here in Chicago. Justin will tell you most likely about his ministry, so I'm going to leave him with that, but we also oversee a Russian-speaking congregation in Wheeling, where there are a lot of Russian Jewish people. We planted a new congregation, not quite downtown, but sort of halfway in between Skokie and downtown, which is really like a gentrified, hip, young family, intermarried area. We've just started Northwestern University. We're about to start an interfaith. I use the term interfaith to my advantage, okay, because that means that Jewish people will attend. Of course it's interfaith. I'll tell you about Jewish things and Christian things, you know, at one of the largest senior, not assisted living, but independent living facilities in Chicago on Sheridan Road. You can pray for that. That should start hopefully within the next month. And I'm really hoping a lot for that. And my goal in a lot of these things is not only I'm starting a lot of these things, but my goal is to recruit a lot of Moody kids and Trinity kids to come and participate. Maybe they come on staff in the future. And even if they don't, maybe they can take things over so I can start other things. But when you have colleges like Northwestern University and University of Chicago, I mean, at the University of Chicago alone, over one quarter of the graduate students are Jewish. 26-27%. Come on, right? There's at least 3,000 Jewish students at Northwestern. There's a bunch at DePaul. So, I mean, good place to do Jewish ministry. And we're trying to brainstorm ways of doing Jewish professional ministry as well. We're going to start something through a church downtown, sort of like we're doing with the seniors, but in a more youth-oriented way. We also host high-end outreach events over Jewish holidays. So one thing we affectionately call the Classy Passy, we don't say that out loud, but you know that's what we call it. It's the Classy Passover. So we have just God-given connections to this incredible club called the Metropolitan Club, which is in the Willis Tower. And so we hold dinners and we find believing chefs who are five-star chefs to come and do the cooking, and it's a great way to invite your business and financial associates to a Passover dinner that they'll hear the gospel at. We're also doing something called Psalm Enchanted Evening, P-S-A-L-M, Psalm Enchanted Evening, with a gentleman named Marty Goetz, who is a classically trained pianist, and it is a black tie event, also in the Willis Tower. But you can see there's lots of different facets to reaching Jewish people, and God has given us some incredible missionaries here in Chicago that I get to oversee. Funny thing is, they're all older than me. So I have my job. You know, it'll be challenging, but in a good way. And one of my main goals is to recruit great people, because Trinity and Moody are incredible, and Moody has a Jewish studies program unlike any other in any Bible college in the country. So a lot of work here. That's a little bit about us. I want to do this real quick with you. You all should have received one of these when you walked in, probably one per family. Take that out with me. And we're going to do an ancient Jewish tradition called the tear-off. Okay? Did anybody not receive one? Okay. On the count of three, we're going to do the tear-off. One, two, three. Oh, that's not enough tearing. There we go. That's all right. Ancient Jewish tradition. You're all Jewish. Now circumcision. No? No circumcision joke laughers? Okay. Well, as you will probably hear from Jeremiah and Justin, all three of us are missionaries. Justin works with us, and Jeremiah works with another ministry. We are missionaries with I'm a missionary with Chosen People Ministries, and we exist to share the gospel with Jewish people and to help you do the same. And what we do is we actually have to raise our own support in order to do that. It's not like a general fund supports all of us. We have to raise our own support. So in order to go to Northwestern, in order to do digital ads and follow up on these people and all sorts of things that I've shared with you today, it's because of like-minded individuals and churches just like yourselves. And we have partnerships with all of these people. The best way to keep up with us is to fill out this slip that you see and to give it to me before you leave today. There is no obligation, no financial obligation to do that. But what you will receive is our prayer letter and our monthly email that gives you updates about our family and about people you can pray for. I can tell you right now, you can pray for three people, Jason, Ross, and Caroline, who I met on Thursday, especially Caroline, who will be meeting with us shortly when I get back in town. She was very interested in finding out more about the Lord. So I've told people about others to pray for, and then they come to faith. So I hope that's the case here as well. That's the best way to keep in touch with us. As far as a partnership, if the Lord moves you, we ask that you would consider joining our partnership team either prayerfully on a regular basis or also financially on a regular basis. One-time gifts or random gifts are also welcome. But that is the awkward financial part of the morning, and I encourage you to stay in touch. We do pray for our partners, okay, which means that we ask you to keep up with us, just like we tell you what's going on in our world, sort of like Paul reported to Jerusalem on his missionary exploits. If you'd like more information about us, you can also visit our website. Chosen People has one, of course, chosenpeople.com, but we also have a little personal website called homeofshalom.com. homeofshalom.com. You can see videos and photos and a few articles here and there, and yes, I know it's in bad need of updating, but it's good. It's good enough for right now. So make sure you give that to me by the end of the day or drop it in the basket. Again, there is no obligation. You will start receiving emails or letters in the next month or two. Okay. Were there any lingering questions or comments from the first session before I continue?
So, this is just an awareness thing. You talked about picking up the piece of paper about going to Israel when you're in college.
Yeah.
Is that a God thing?
Totally. It was actually sidewalk chalk. It was a total God thing when I saw, you know, when I decided I wanted to get away, and that morning I saw free trip to Israel written on the sidewalk. Yeah. Absolutely. It's totally God. I mean, he totally changed everything about my life. I was in a communications degree. I was going to do something with mass communication probably. Isn't that funny? Is that funny in a not really funny in a totally God-intended sort of way? Yeah. Anything else? Okay, we're sort of shifting gears here. However, my hope is that by sharing what we're about to talk about, it will actually help you reach Jewish people. Because what we're going to talk about is more Bible and theology, but in a really good way, because you'll see things hopefully that you've never seen before. However, you'll also recognize that, you know, if you have a friend and you say, I don't know how to start a conversation with them, if it's this time of year, you can mention the holidays, because that's what we're going to talk about. You can say, did you observe the holidays? Or what did you do, if anything, for Yom Kippur or for Rosh Hashanah? And they're going to be like, why are you asking that? And it doesn't matter. It just opens up the doors to talk about things of faith, spirituality, and culture. Okay? Sometimes that's all you need. You don't have to go right directly to Jesus, but it gets you in. You could say, hey, there was this Jewish guy who taught us about the holidays. Or, yeah, I was reading about it in my Bible. So that's what I'd like us to do. I'd like us to turn to everyone's favorite book of the Bible, which, of course, is? Yeah. Pastor Roger? Leviticus. Everybody turn to Leviticus. Because I want you to get this framework. This will be the book with the pages that are worn thin. I do want to show you a picture of my family. That now, in Israel, his name is Ben Sion. We call him Ben Zion here, and we call him Benzi in the house. He's Benzi. That, unfortunately, is a little bit old since he's now two, but that's Benzi and myself and my incredible wife, Jessica. You can see I'm also the National Director of Young Adult Mobilization and Evangelism. So this, in a nutshell, and you don't want to copy this down, I'm just showing you the overview because I have been asked to do this entire thing, and that takes about an hour and a half to 45 minutes. This is what we're going to talk about today, but it's going to be the right half. But here's why I wanted to show you this. When you turn to Leviticus 23, you get the most unique snapshot of two different things. Number one, in Leviticus 23, you get a snapshot of the worship life of the children of Israel. Okay? Because God gives what's called moadim, or appointed times. Please don't copy this down. I'll send you this. Don't copy this one down. It's too many notes. But he gives us moadim, and it's really cool because in Genesis chapter 1, when God creates the stars in the sky for seasons and years, the word that he uses when he says seasons and years is moadim. It's appointed times. And we translate that usually as holiday or festival, okay? But it's really kind of better as an appointed time because what God was intending to do, not only by giving us time for the day, was he said, listen, I have to delineate each day. But by doing that, I'm also going to mark on my spiritual God calendar the days that you are supposed to come and meet with me. And so he gave us appointed times for those days. And so we actually have 8 appointed times in Leviticus chapter 23. 8 appointed times. So I want to ask you this, and this sort of is interesting because we, in Western culture, we like to separate every single little nuance and concept, but it didn't happen in the Middle Eastern world. So sometimes we'll separate the idea of faith and works. Okay? To God, there's no such separation. And I'll show you what I mean. Could you follow everything that God commanded in the first 5 books of the Bible and not have faith in him? Well, I'd say yes. Sure, why not? Okay, well, you're taking the one spiritual one. I understand what you mean. Okay, Becky. All right. But you understand my point here. You can go through the motions and not have any heart in it. I mean, you might be in a loveless marriage, and you can do the right things for a while and not love them. But can you love God with all your heart, soul, and strength and not do the commandments? No. If you know that loving God means, if you know God wants X, Y, and Z, and you love him, well, of course, you're going to do X, Y, and Z. There is no difference. Now, that one may come first. I mean, you could literally say, well, technically, I loved first, then I followed. But they're together. They're joint. So when these are mentioned in the Bible, there were a lot of times when the children of Israel did these things, these holidays out of not necessity, but just because they were supposed to, as opposed to faith. And also, you'll see them in the New Testament. And there are certain holidays that are actually called pilgrimage feasts, 3 of them specifically, where the Jewish people, the men of a certain age, have to be in Jerusalem. So you'll even notice, it'll say, as this holiday was approaching, Jesus was here, but only for a day because he was then going to Jerusalem. Because in order to be our Messiah, he has to be perfect. He has to follow all these commandments. If he broke one, he's not our Messiah. He sinned. But he would go to Jerusalem because it was a pilgrimage feast. So it's kind of like little cool things when you see these holidays. Why do you think it was so crowded on the Feast of Pentecost? It was a pilgrimage feast called Shavuot. Penta is 50. Shavuot means weeks, W-E-E-K-S. 7 weeks plus 1 day, according to Leviticus 23, is 50. Well, why we have Pentecost, 50. So this was a holiday, 50 days after Passover, and all the Jewish men were supposed to be in Jerusalem. That's why it was so crowded when the Spirit descended onto the people in Acts. So, you'll go through this and you'll see that according to what we have up here, there is 7 feasts. But how many feasts did I say there were? Which one is missing? Sort of a tricky question, I know. The first one says Pesach or Passover. The second one says the Feast of Matzah or Unleavened Bread. We treat them as one holiday now, but they're technically two holidays according to Leviticus. Third one says Yom HaBikurim, First Fruits. That happened on the day after the Sabbath of the week of Passover. What day is the Sabbath? What day is the day after the Sabbath? What happened the Sunday, Jesus' final week on earth, the day after the Sabbath? He rose from the dead. Why do you think they called him the first fruits of the resurrection? Because it was the holiday of first fruits. And by the way, you wave the first fruits of the harvest knowing that more harvest is to come. This is good stuff. You should have me back for that one. And the last holiday of the spring, because these holidays actually sort of coincided not with the prophetic future, also they coincided with the planting season. So you had a second harvest holiday. The first one was first fruits. A second harvest holiday called Shavuot, which I just told you about. That was like the bigger one. It would be 50 days after Passover. Now, Shavuot is the time when Jewish people celebrate the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Because they say 50 days after they left Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai. God gave Moses the tablets with the inscribed laws. And as you know, in Acts chapter 2, God wrote the law, his law, on our hearts through the work of the Holy Spirit. So on one hand, you have hearts of stone, right? Hearts with following the commandments on stone. And then you have hearts that are following commandments that are written on our souls and our flesh. It's a much more personal way to do things, okay? So you have these holidays that coincide with things that happened in Jesus' life. Passover, I hope you know about. Okay. That's a whole other message too. So you have all of these holidays, and the one that's missing is Shabbat, the Sabbath. Because the Sabbath is an overarching holiday that is supposed to happen throughout the year. It's not just one time. It's every 7 days. Now, Yeshua was called Lord of the Sabbath, right? Because the Sabbath was a day when you rested from the work. Well, what does Yeshua do? But he allows us to rest from working in addition to having faith in the Lord. We don't have to work our way to God anymore, following the 613 commandments that were given in the Torah. So when he becomes the Lord of the Sabbath, it's because he gives us rest. He becomes our rest from striving. Then you have the middle there, harvesting season. And what we're going to do is we're going to focus on all the holidays to the right of harvesting season. You'll notice there's a line on the left, right, that goes through all the dots. You see where the cross is. But the line stops because the rest hasn't happened yet. So the difference we're going to talk about today are the spring feasts and the fall feasts. The three fall feasts that we're going to talk about. Well, I already showed you that part. Here, this might be a better picture of those first ones if you weren't able to read them. But I can also send you this. Now, in Leviticus 23, you get this calendar. And what's really cool is not only is this a calendar for the people of Israel to meet with the Lord, not only is this a calendar that coincides with the harvest, which it did, this is also a calendar for the entire time frame of the world that God created. So we have 1 year and 365 days, right? But imagine all of eternity being this calendar. So if I go back for a second, see that little area between Passover and the white side of the image? That's creation until Jesus. It doesn't exactly fit the word picture, but you understand what I mean. Then we have this whole Jesus stuff, the Passover, the first fruits, the Shavuot, and these all coincide with things in his life. And we're waiting for the fulfillment of those other things that are going to come. So we're going to talk about the three fall holidays that we just observed. We're going to talk about them in modernity, what Jewish people think of them now. And we're going to talk about them briefly in antiquity, how Jewish people used to celebrate them, but also what they look like prophetically. And here's why. When these events, as if they're prophetic, are fulfilled, it will be nothing short of God reclaiming what he lost at the Garden of Eden. It will be the restoration of the kingdom. It will be the eradication of sin and death. It will be justice forever. It is God's reclamation of his kingdom. This is what we're waiting for. This is what we're desiring. We not only have a grandpa God, we also have a God with the tongue of a sword who will judge in a really interesting way those who are for him and those who are against him. And I know that's not a popular message, but this is what the Bible talks about when it talks about the day of judgment. And you're preaching out of the book of Revelation. So, I mean, I know you're sort of familiar with this stuff. But the three holidays are God's reclamation of his kingdom, and they have yet to happen prophetically fulfilled. So let's go through them. First, you have the Feast of Trumpets, Rosh Hashanah. Now, and you'll find that one in Leviticus 23:23. The Feast of Trumpets is really kind of interesting because it has a different name now than it did in the Bible. In the Bible, it was Yom Teruah, the Day of Trumpeting. When you had a trumpet, that you would use it for, I mean, it was a natural implement because you got it from a ram. I remember going to Israel with my wife, like the first time we went, and I was looking at some rams, and I said, that's the shofar I want. That's the trumpet I want, because they're called shofars. And it's kind of a morbid thought, because you're talking about taking the horn off of that ram, and I want to use it as my trumpet. But remember we said the watchmen on the walls, they would have shofars. They would have trumpets. Trumpets were used for warning people. They were used for celebration. They were used for a coming dignitary. They were used to gather people. They were used for signals. There were lots of reasons. And the only thing the Bible says about this holiday throughout the entire Old Testament is that you're to blow trumpets. So you imagine this day rolls around in antiquity, and all of a sudden, everybody who's got a trumpet just starts blowing their trumpet everywhere. I remember I was a real, I was a guy with a lot of nerve in college. And one time I decided to bug everybody and make, I'm not that far removed, but I went into the library while everybody was studying for finals with my shofar. And I started blowing my shofar in the library. And of course, people thought I was very rude and immature, and I probably was. But I thought it was hilarious. But all of a sudden, trumpets all over Jerusalem start going off. Trumpets all over Israel start going off. For what reason? Because God said to blow trumpets. That's really it. But today, we call this holiday Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah. Rosh is head. Hashanah is year. Head of the year. First of the year. And here's why that's weird. If you look at verse 5 of chapter 23, what does your heading say above verse 4? Leviticus 23:4. Passover of unleavened bread, right? Okay. Verse 5, on the 14th day of the first month. That's weird, right? So why do we call Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah, why do we call the Feast of Trumpets head of the year, Rosh Hashanah? Because this is a complete reactionary thing to what the rabbis have done with the absence of a temple. So the temple was needed for sacrifices. Sacrifices were needed for sin offerings. Without a temple, you can't do sacrifices. So without sacrifices, you can't have sin being forgiven. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD, 40 years after Jesus was crucified and rose from the dead. So what they say is on Rosh Hashanah, and by the way, this is one of the holidays where Jewish people will fill the synagogue, even if they're not there all year long. This is the Easter of the synagogue. That's when the church gets full, right? On this day, the rabbis tell us that God opens three books. The book of life, which is in the Bible, the book of death, and the book of somewhere in between. If you're immediately righteous, he writes you in the book of life for 1 year. If you're immediately evil, he writes you in the book of death. If you're somewhere in between, you have a few days to make up for it. Ask me where that is in the Bible. Nowhere. It's nowhere. But Jewish people will go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and they will say prayers asking for forgiveness. They will recite specific prayers, and they know that they have 10 days in between that and the next holiday to make up. Because on the next holiday, which is Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, they will either get written in the Book of Life or the Book of Death for 1 year. And how do they do that? Their good deeds have to outweigh their bad. Okay. Now, on the Day of Atonement, which is 10 days later, after what we call the 10 days of awe, which is that intermediary period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in antiquity, this is the day that the high priest was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies within the temple. He would put on special white garments. There were washing ceremonies beforehand so that he was ceremonially clean. There would be two goats, and on each goat he would cast lots. One would be the scapegoat and one would be the sacrifice goat. This was the day that when the scapegoat was chosen, it was led out of the city and away. It was led far away into the wilderness to die. It symbolized that the sin was leaving the house of Israel, all the people of Israel. But on the other goat, the sacrifice goat, the high priest would lay his hands on that goat and confess the sins of the entire house of Israel. Because the Day of Atonement wasn't just individual atonement, that's how we think about it. It was atonement for the entire nation of Israel. Okay? You'll find a little bit about this in Leviticus chapter 23, 26, but you'll find a little bit more throughout the Torah on how this was supposed to happen. So the priest would take the goat for the sacrifice after the scapegoat had been led away. He would sacrifice it on the altar, take its blood, and go into the Holy of Holies and sprinkle the blood around. That's where we get the term scapegoat, because this was the goat that all of the fault of Israel was placed. He would die for their sins. Talk about an idea of substitutionary atonement. We get it all the way back in the Torah. Now, what's really interesting is that according to the rabbis, the high priests and the priests of the temple did a few things differently on this day. Number one, they tied, besides everything that I already described, the last thing is they tied a red or a scarlet ribbon on the door of the temple. And after they made the sacrifice and as the scapegoat was led away, every single year it turned white. This is in rabbinic literature that this is what happened, symbolizing that God was accepting the sacrifice made by the Jewish people on behalf of the entire nation. Now, this happens every year, by the way. It's not just a one-time thing. Today, what happens is that Jewish people also flood the synagogue, and they go into what's called, in the evening, a Kol Nidre service. Kol Nidre means all vows. And in the morning, there's another service. And this is the day when we're told that God opens both books again. The only problem that we have here is that people don't know which book they get written into, hypothetically, if it were true. But again, they go and they beat their chests, symbolizing that they understand that they need punishment, but they're asking God for mercy. They even recite a long, long list of sins that you could be guilty of, and it's customary to recite them corporately. What's also unfortunate is that in all these synagogues, a lot of these people have no clue what they're saying because it's in Hebrew. You know, a lot of times there's translation on the other side of the page, but they don't look. But these are the big days. This is the day when people are there. This is the day in this 10-day period before and after Rosh Hashanah, but before Yom Kippur, people will apologize. People will ask forgiveness. People will give money to charities. People will give money to the synagogue in hopes that they merit their way to God. Ask me where that is in the Bible. It's not there. You already knew that one. Lastly, that brings us to the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, which we're currently in. If you went to a very Orthodox neighborhood, you would see these makeshift huts in the backyards or on the balconies. And in Brooklyn, it's so funny because there are these neighborhoods where it's just every balcony, there's this little sort of structure on it. And this is a really cool one. This is a holiday that commemorates when the Jewish people dwelled with God in the wilderness after they came out of the land of Egypt. They were supposed to make structures. And when God commanded this in the book of Exodus, he actually commanded a specific way to do it, and it's laid out here in Leviticus as well. You were supposed to make it of three walls, and some of the rabbis added some rules. But according to traditional standards, there was supposed to be a roof that you could see the stars through. Now, in the wilderness, you would have these, everybody would have their own. You have these little structures that they lived in the desert as they traveled through. And when God would move their cloud or the pillar of fire, they would get their hut and they would move it, their tabernacle or their booth. On one hand, it was a really bad experience because they were in no permanent place. They were sort of Bedouins. They were just moving from here to there. And they weren't in the promised land. But on the other hand, it was exactly where they wanted to be. Think about it. God just saved you through so many miraculous means, it wasn't funny. Not only that, he drowned your pursuers. Not only that, he met you at Mount Sinai. Not only that, he gave you his law at Mount Sinai. Not only that, after you sinned and made the golden calf and a lot of you died, he gave you another law at Mount Sinai. And you were in his presence. And he was guiding you, even though you were very stubborn. Good place to be, because when you came out of your tabernacle or your booth, all you had to do was look towards the center and you would see that, the tabernacle, the tabernacle. And you would see God's pillar, knowing his presence was with you, knowing you were where you were supposed to be. And when they wanted direction, all they would do was wait for Moses to go in or out. And Moses would give them directions through the priest, through Aaron and his brothers and his sons. It was a really cool place to be. And now you have these sukkahs, tabernacles built in the yards and on the balconies. And it's traditional to either sleep in them, but, you know, we're in Chicago, so it's a little bit cold right now. But you sleep in them, you eat in them, and it's really considered a wonderful thing to have guests over and to be able to eat in your sukkah. And you keep this for 8 days. This is an 8-day holiday. And this is the last holiday. But let me explain the prophetic significance of some of these holidays. Because remember, these three holidays, if the first holidays, the spring holidays, were God's invitation to his kingdom, the fall feasts are the establishment and the reclamation of his kingdom. So you may have been invited, and now you're going to see it. Okay? So Rosh Hashanah, turn with me to Matthew chapter 24, verse 31. Matthew 24, 31. Remember, this is the Day of Trumpets, Rosh Hashanah. Matthew 24:31. Let's start in verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. If you want to see this picture, because remember when I told you Jesus, what I like to call them are echoes. He echoes things from the scripture. If you want to get the picture that he's describing here, it's already been described in the book of Daniel. It's not the first time. But when he talks about this, the Jewish people listening are already conjuring up the idea, oh, this is someone special who's coming with the authority of God and power. At least that's the picture you get in the book of Daniel. And he, in verse 31, and he will send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. So on this occasion, trumpets will sound and he is here. The person we've been waiting for that was prophesied in the book of Daniel. We don't know exactly what he's going to do, but now Jesus is saying not only is he going to come with great power and glory, we're going to see him, we're going to hear the trumpet, and he's going to gather his elect. Gather his elect. Interesting. Turn to 1 Corinthians 15. Verse 52. We'll start in verse 51. 15:51, 1 Corinthians. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. I want you to start thinking about it this way. What were the reasons for the trumpet? Joy, celebration. What else? Sound the alarm. An announcement. A coming dignitary. Those all fit. The King of Kings is riding on clouds in great glory at the sound of the trumpet. It's the King returning to establish his throne. Nothing short of the King returning. I'm not talking about Lord of the Rings. Thank you for the one person who laughed. If you want to write another one down, it's 1 Thessalonians 4:16. So all of a sudden we have the King who just came and everyone has noticed. Sound the alarm. But it's an alarm of celebration and it's the coming King of Kings. And we see him. I don't know if he'll look like that, you know. Maybe he'll come with a sword. Maybe he'll, you know, I guess we'll find out eventually. And then we come to Yom Kippur. So we have this day of trumpeting, a day of celebration, a coming dignitary. And then after that, we have the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Turn to Romans 11:25. Remember, I told you that this was the holiday where all of the Jewish people were atoned for as the high priest confessed their sins on the goat. Well, just like all of the house of Israel was atoned for, I believe that this is the day that all of Israel will be saved. In the book of Revelation, it talks about the woman being ushered into the wilderness to be protected, to be saved. In Romans 11:25, it says, "For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel," meaning part of Israel does not recognize that Jesus is the Messiah, "until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in." That's you all. "And then, so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion. He will turn away ungodliness from Jacob." Somehow, in the future, when the fullness of the Gentiles comes in, God sees fit to save all of the Jewish people. So you ask yourself, well, then why is this dude here talking about Jewish evangelism? Because it's too late for my grandmother. Because it's too late for my grandfather. It's too late for some of my uncles and aunts. If you go to the grave without him, it's too late. So my belief is that the ones who are alive on earth will see him in a very specific way, and I'll show you how. Turn to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. It says, "And I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication." Supplication is a fancy word for prayer. "Then they will look on me, whom they have pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn." Remember, this was written before Jesus. And God is speaking. He says, "They will look on me, whom they have pierced." Obviously, Jesus was God in flesh, so he was already pierced. or he would be pierced. And they will mourn. So what I think is going to happen, Jesus returns with the trumpets. Jewish people look on him, and they realize, not just Jewish people, by the way, there'll be a lot of others, look to him and realize we missed him. They'll see the evidence with the scars in his hands and on his feet. They'll see the power and glory that he comes with. And in a day, this is what I believe, the Jewish people alive will recognize that Jesus is their Messiah. And a lot of other people will too. And even still, many will still run and rebel. But this is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So if Rosh Hashanah was the returning king, Yom Kippur is about the king saving his people. One cool thing about Yom Kippur that is in the Talmud, which is rabbinic writings, there were a couple things that occurred 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The temple was destroyed in 70, which makes the 40 years before 30, roughly the time that Jesus was crucified and resurrected. These are the four things that occurred. The rabbis tell us that the lot that the high priest would cast on the goats stopped falling in the right hand. It only fell in the left hand for the last 40 years of the temple's existence. Number two, what I just said? Okay. There were four things that happened. They would cast lots for the goat. How they did it exactly, I'm not sure, but according to the rabbis, it had to do with whatever they were holding, they would mix up and they would pick up. And the lot for the sacrifice goat would stop falling in the right hand. It never fell in the right hand anymore. Number two, the menorah of the temple, the candelabra, wouldn't stay lit. The furthest candle wouldn't stay lit, and so they had to continually relight it, which is not good because this is supposed to be an eternal menorah, always going. The temple doors would not stay shut. Do you remember when Jesus was crucified and the curtain of the temple was rent? And this is the coolest thing, I think. Remember that red sash? It stopped turning white. This is written in rabbinic literature, not Christian literature. This is from the rabbis themselves. That stopped happening. So we have the king returning, the king saving his people, and then we have Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. I want you to turn to Revelation, please. The only thing to do is to usher his saved people into his kingdom. Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. It's the last book. People laugh at my jokes. It can be funny as we study. All right. Revelation 21, verse 1. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from the heaven of God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the what? Tabernacle, not a mistake. Remember, this is the Feast of Tabernacles. The tabernacle of God is with men, just like it was back in the wilderness. The only difference is it's in the always intended location. The New Jerusalem, the kingdom, what we're waiting for. And he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Now go to Revelation 22:1. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp, nor the light of sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Remember in the wilderness, at night, there would be a pillar of fire. I have to believe that gave him some light. But in the new tabernacle, they don't even need the sun and the stars, because the Lord himself apparently can light every single corner and every single crevice. And they don't need the sun and the stars anymore. There is no curse, because the tabernacle of God is with men, because the tabernacle in the wilderness was a foreshadow of a much, much greater paradise. Now, one thing, this is cool. This is the end of the calendar. This is a seven-day holiday, right? No, it's an eight-day holiday, which is weird. 7 days is the number of completion. The eighth day of Sukkot is called the Hoshana Rabbah. Does Hoshana sound familiar? Hoshana? Hosanna. Hosanna means save. Save now. Hoshana Rabbah was the last day. This is kind of how I like to look at it. As 7 days is completion, the eighth day is like for the everlasting. Because after this, after Revelation, there is no need for another calendar year. There's no need for another Passover. There's no need for another Pentecost. There's no need for another Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. There's no sin and death. There's no curse. So you have 7 days as if it's all completed, and one day for eternity. Live with God for eternity. God has finally reclaimed what we messed up at the Garden of Eden. But it's even better than what was at the Garden. It's kind of neat if you also look at the Jewish wedding ceremony. And Jesus alludes to this in his parables. A bride would wait for her husband to come and get her, but did not know the hour he was coming. What he did was he went home and he built a house onto his father's house. What do you think Jesus said in my father's house? You know? And only when the father told him it was time would he go and get the bride. And so he would go with his groom's party, essentially, the entire wedding party, to go get the bride, not knowing when it was going to happen. I like the parable that Jesus tells, you know, about the virgins being ready for their groom, because you don't know when it's coming. But when the groom comes, they come with great fanfare and great hoopla, and everybody is celebrating because he is going to take his bride home. It's sort of like this. It's sort of like this. Are there any questions? Please be aware that, as I hope you're in awe of the way that God has planned his history out, you're also sad, because the Jewish people not only miss the prophetic significance, but have created ways around Jesus. Created ways that aren't biblical, having to merit your way to God. I mean, I've been in synagogue services where I remember the first time I took my wife to a Yom Kippur service, the most holy day of the year in Judaism. And she says, "This is so sad. And it's boring." And nobody wants to be there. Nobody. They're there out of obligation. And they believe something that was told to them by rabbis, and they're not even looking at it for themselves because they're satisfied. They're told they're probably going to be covered. Oh, were you written in the book of life? I don't know. What you say is Lishana Tova Tikatevu, to a good new year. But it has the concept of being inscribed. May you be inscribed for a good new year. Inscribed in the book of life. There's no hope, though. They don't know. So, that's my people. Great question. Return of the Messiah? There's no return of the Messiah if they don't believe the Messiah has come. Most are not looking for the Messiah. There are a few religious sects that are still looking for the Messiah, but a lot of, if you're looking at Judaism like a spectrum, the more reformed, the not so religious side, have changed the concept of the Messiah to be we're all the Messiah. So we have this concept called Tikkun Olam. Is the Lord telling us something? Called Tikkun Olam, which means repair of the world. We all have a part to play in the repair of the world. But it really doesn't have much to do with God. But look about this. You know what that reminded me of? The harvest. Remember when Jesus said that the fields are white? Where on that timeline are we? What do you think our job is? We're in the harvest until the king returns, saves his people, and establishes the kingdom. That's our job. We're harvesters. It all makes sense why he says all this stuff. We're in the middle of the harvest. Thank you, tree. Yeah, that's made a lot of news this year. I don't follow it too much because, to me, what they're doing is they're trying to find a red heifer, and that's perfectly red, has no miscolor hairs, and they need that for the ashes as part of the temple sacrifice system. Of course, it's more headlines than anything else. It's more money being raised than anything else, in my opinion. When people go to Israel, they always visit this thing called the Temple Institute because they've made implements for the future temple that they believe will be established at some point. These are really, really religious Orthodox Jews. They get so much money from tourists to watch their 14-minute video. But they can't do anything. They're not going to go up there and destroy the Dome of the Rock. Any other questions? That's true. That's what they would figure. That's what they would figure, yes. Do I have thoughts? Yes, I have thoughts. Do I place any significance on them? No. Not whatsoever. I'll be very honest. Forgive me if you think differently. Can we say why? Is that why? Are you? It's pretty simple. This has happened not three times, but five times. Two other times, nothing happened. And if something significant happens with Israel, something always significant happens with Israel. So, what are you going to point to? The Jewish people in general. There, in addition, some of the things that have been pointed to as have happened during a year with four blood red eclipse moons, which, by the way, looks super cool, just in general. Some of them didn't happen in the same calendar year. They happened the year after or the year before. So you sell a lot of books, though, don't you? It has nothing to do with that. It's just that I don't see the pattern. And you have to read into it a lot. I mean, some people are reading into the hurricane until yesterday when it turned its path and didn't come to the United States. So do you think that because Mahmoud Abbas is preaching nonsense in the UN, that's the reason, you know, come on. It could, absolutely. But don't ask me about the Harbinger or the Shemitah either, because I don't buy any of it. But you sell a lot of books, don't you? That being said, my mother-in-law owns a Christian bookstore and sold a lot of The Harbinger. And Jonathan Cahn is generally a nice guy, but, you know, I just don't agree with his take on this, the scriptures he used. If you're not familiar with it, great, don't read it. Forgive me if you have. That is not the view of chosen people. That's Ryan Karp's view. Yes. Or the world. Oh, I'd say it's probably around 15%. It depends what you say when you mean practicing. Orthodox Judaism is probably around 10 to 15%. Then you would have to call the rest of people, people that had a faith in God but didn't practice in an Orthodox way. That is really, you can't estimate that. But Israel was founded as a socialist country back in 1948. That's how they survived because they had to. It was a land that was not flowing with milk and honey at the time. It was a land that was desolate, and they had to share crop. They shared everything. They farmed together. It is a largely secular society with a small religious minority who mandates a lot of laws, and the seculars and the religious do not like each other, which gives us an interesting opportunity to share with the seculars because we're not considered religious. You know, we don't wear yarmulkes and stuff, and not all of us. Most of us don't. So if we have, we tell them about a unique rabbi who bucked the system of the religious authority. Well, that, absolutely, he's revolutionary. It's true.
Have you seen an increasing openness among those in Israel?
Yes. We have seen an increasing openness, mostly among young people, which is really, I mean, nobody saw that one coming. The openness for the last 20 to 30 years was amongst the former Soviet Union people. People that came to Brooklyn and New York, people that went to Israel, and people that went to Australia. Tons of Russian Jewish people who got out of the Soviet Union when it fell. And they tremendously open, and still are, more so than almost any other group. But young, sort of secular Israelis are open if you can talk to them in the right way and be culturally relevant. No, France, no, because France was such a closed Jewish culture because they had to protect their identity, and because of occasional anti-Semitism, they were so close-knit. When you're a close-knit Jewish community, you usually become less open. So the more, I mean, this is kind of just like anthropology, the more fractured you are as a community, the easier it is to break into the community. So. Not really with the French, but we're trying. I mean, France has the third largest Jewish population in the world. Israel, United States, and France. But it's about 6 million behind America. So it's much smaller. It's less than a million now. It's probably somewhere around 600,000. But it was 900,000 just 20 years ago. In general or our specific ministry? I ask that you would pray for this new initiative that we have called I Found Shalom, which I told you about. We are going national with it now. And so we are getting many, many Jewish people on our website to look at these videos and hopefully order a free booklet. That being said, we could follow up on all these people. What else? Three things. Yeah, I would pray specifically that doors would open on college campuses specifically, because this is such a largely untapped field, that when I tell you how many people are reaching Jewish people on campus, you will be shocked. Because full-time, reaching Jewish people on campus, there's probably zero. Zero in the United States and Canada. In Israel, there might be one or two. I'm not doing it full time, although I'm probably doing it part time, which is more than anybody else. And there's a difference between showing up with a book table, which we do, and trying to make inroads with all of the Christian groups and trying to become a campus group so that you're an established entity on campus, which is what I'm trying to do. That is only being done by like one other person. And again, he's not even full time and he's in Florida. So we need workers and openings. We need to figure out how to do it. It was done in the 70s when everybody could just pass out tracts, and now that doesn't really work. And in Chicago, it's too cold after, what, November. So to be outside, so we have to figure out innovative ways to be inside and to engage with people. So college, I found Shalom. I think those two are good. I can think of any number of things to pray for, but... Oh, absolutely. That's beside the point. That is the point, actually. Yes, sir. The homeless and the needy?
Sir?
The homeless and the needy, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so regarding Israel, is there a place where they're housed? The central Tel Aviv bus station is like a wasteland. You need to wear rough-soled shoes because you will be stepping on piles of needles. So Tel Aviv is big on that. Eilat, which is all the way to the southern tip on the Red Sea, is big on that. You know, there are homeless in Jerusalem, of course. But Tel Aviv and Eilat are big for that. How are they viewed? They're viewed as a nuisance. A lot of these people, a nuisance. Their view, some of them are trafficked into the country. The government is really interesting because on one hand, they're super compassionate, and on the other hand, they're not, because they accept refugees, sort of, and don't really make them leave. So a lot of Sudanese and Eritrean Muslims fleeing issues from their country risk their lives to travel through Egypt and then cross the border into Israel. Why would Muslims want to come to a Jewish state? Because they're free there. And I don't mean free like they have rights as citizens, but they're much better off there than they were in Eritrea or Sudan. And it's weird because they're Muslims traveling through Egypt. If Egypt sees them, they shoot them. And what happens when they come in, they get put into a detention center. For about 3 months, they're cataloged and they're let go. They're not made to go back. So that on one hand, you put them in a detention center. That's mean. They're escaping. On the other hand, they're still able to live in Israel, and they work. So, and they do jobs that other Israelis don't want to do. So, on the other hand, it's compassionate. Now, they want them to leave. In fact, Israel offers them money to go back to their country, but none of them are doing it. They'll say, here's $5,000 for each member of your family to go back to your country. 5,000. You have five members, it's $25,000. None of them are taking it. So, there are programs. I mean, we have programs in Israel that work with drug addicts and prostitutes and things like that. But if you've ever done work with that crowd, it's not easy because they just go back on the street. You can give them a place to stay, but they're back on the street the next day. There are several. Yeah, actually, most of them are in partnership with the state of Israel because obviously Israel wants more and more people to live there. They want more and more Jewish people to live there. Not so much from Africa. They've closed their base in Ethiopia. But from the former Soviet Union, from Europe, I mean, when that thing in France happened the most recently, I remember Netanyahu went to France and said, Jews of France, you're welcome home. And he didn't mean France. A small amount, but we have it good here. Once anti-Semitism starts happening in the United States like it's happening in Europe, listen, as far as I can tell, everything in culture goes this way. Europe, Canada, United States. Europe's already doing it. Canada's going to be next, and will be next. it's sad because we're only 70 years removed, and the things that are happening you think couldn't happen, like the shooting in Belgium and the things in France. And I mean, we held a conference in France 1 year exactly before the shootings happened at the Jewish grocery store and at Charlie Hebdo. Okay? It was half a mile from where we put 150 young Jews. Now, if they had known where we were, we would have been a target. The fact that I don't think I could safely hold a Jewish conference for young Jewish believers in, it doesn't matter, we believe in Jesus, okay? The fact that I can't hold one safely in Paris boggles my mind. Paris is one of the biggest, most renowned cities in the entire world, and I can't safely hold a Jewish conference there? In a city where they have hundreds of thousands of Jews between Paris and Marseille? I mean, come on. So we did it in Madrid. I mean, we didn't do it in Paris. We did, although people from Madrid went to Paris, and we actually had to, like, try to figure out if they were okay and, you know, make sure they were okay because they went right after the conference, and it happened right then. Oh, absolutely. That's not a big thought, but it has become a thought, which... When was the last time you thought about security for Christians? Although after this Oregon shooting, we're starting to think more and more about it, aren't we? Let's pray. Father, once again, we thank you so much that we're able to come and talk about your word, a people that you still love. But moreover, Lord, I hope these words become action. And I hope action becomes faith. And I hope faith becomes more faith. And I know that you are the power behind all of this, so we submit to you. B'Shem Yeshua. Amen.